5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode 300 of Past Gas. This week, we're talking about the Great Train Robbery, one of the great crimes in British history that has a surprising connection to open-wheel Formula racing, which we're going to find out right now. The date is August 18th, 1963. The location is Caldwell Park Circuit in Lincolnshire, England. A short 2.1-mile club circuit nestled into the steep sides of a valley, earning it the nickname, the Mini Nürburgring. It's Sunday, race day, and a slew of aspiring young racers have turned up to compete in a series of Formula Junior and Formula Libra open-wheel events, the kind of races you'd run if you're looking to forge a career in something as prestigious as Formula One. Lining up for the main event are the likes of Peter Revson, Denny Hulme, and Mike Spence, all of whom would go on to race in and occasionally win some Grand Prix. Also on the grid was a young man named Roy James, an occasional figure in the British racing world, albeit still one on his way up. Behind the wheel of a Brabham BT6, this young racer took victory in the Formula Junior event. As he celebrated a battle well fought, Roy James had a secret. Just 10 days before, he had played a key role in an audacious Royal Mail train heist, driving away with more money than he and his co-conspirators knew what to do with. Well, Roy James knew what he'd do. He'd go racing. So, within 2 weeks of taking part in a world-renowned crime that we now know today as the Great Train Robbery, here he was at Caldwell Park, taking victory. But what was James's role in the big heist? How did an aspiring racer get roped into a $90 million scandal after growing up in a poor, dysfunctional London home? And what does James have to do with modern F1, even after all these years? We're about to find out on Past Gas episode 300, people!
Woo!
Oh, shit.
300 episodes!
It's the Great Train Robbery!
Wow.
Whoa.
Now, wow. Clean this up!
Dang. That really startled me. Welcome to episode 300. I didn't know we were going to be doing this.
If you're listening, not watching, they just set off some funfetti.
And a lot of confetti.
Those are loud ones.
Those were loud.
I didn't know they'd be so loud.
I think if you watch the footage, you'll see my life flash before my eyes. I saw Audrey hold something up in the periphery and then a loud bang. And I was like, oh, here it is. This is how it ends.
It's just like you... Every part of your life where you're sitting on the couch playing video games flashes.
Ace Combat 5, pretty cool, yeah. Bad Company 2, that was pretty good.
Yeah.
Uncharted 4, that was really good.
And then you come back to reality and you're like, oh, sick. Wouldn't change a thing.
All really good times. Welcome back to Past Gas, everybody. It is episode 300. My name is Nolan Sykes. Joining me as always, it's... Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And Joe G. Weber.
Life's better with a cup of Joe.
300, wow. We got to start with new catchphrases, right? New
catchphrases, that's right. Wow, I really can't believe it. We started doing this show in like late 2019.
Yeah.
And then the world collapsed as we were trying to make this thing happen. I remember the Friday before... quarantine proper, we were just recording up in the valley.
Burbank, that was a really cool studio. SZA recorded there.
That's right. You know, we through everything have persisted and kept on recording the show. And now it is today is let's see, I don't know when this is coming out, but today it's July. It's July 7th.
Yeah. Let's take a look back at the people that helped us.
Yeah. I mean, so many people have been involved in the show.
James was a huge help getting this podcast. I mean, yeah, it was his idea.
Help. Yeah.
Obviously, James Gavin like, Kinsel, who was the recording tech for a long time and editor, Tommy Wellett, who has gone on to work with Tig Notaro,
Christina
was head of podcast forever. Mm-hmm. Not to mention all of our writers who have helped us out in the last 6 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So many names to talk about. Thank you to all of our fans listening.
Yeah. Seriously.
For sticking with us through all these years and episodes. I remember being at like episode 100 and being like, wow, it's been a long time.
Yeah.
What are we going to talk about? And now here we are 200 episodes past.
That's insane, dude.
That.
It's crazy.
Bart has joined us in the last, I'd say 50 episodes.
Has it been 50?
Yeah, has it been 50?
Yeah. I don't know.
It's been a lot.
Yeah.
No, that'd be a whole year.
Almost a year. But we have so many good episodes after this episode. Please tell your friends, like and subscribe.
Ooh, yeah. All right.
Thank you to everyone who listens.
Yeah, thank you. Sincerely, thank you very much. So, to celebrate, again, this is not exactly a car story, but a car-adjacent story, and one that I'm very excited to tell on the show. It's the Great Train Robbery.
This one was written by Elizabeth Blackstock.
Yes.
One of my favorite writers. We had her do this one specifically because she's an amazing storyteller.
Yeah, Liz, she's a U.S. editor over at planetf1.com and also hosts her own podcast, Deadly Passions, Terrible Joys, which is also a very good racing history show. So very excited to have her write this one. Anyway, let's get to it.
Let's jump right in.
When Roy James was born in Fulham to the southwest of London in 1935, the world was on the cusp of dramatic change. World War II was about to pockmark England's capital city with bombing raids, while those remaining in the city were left to scrounge up a living in the rubble, particularly for folks born into dysfunctional, broken families like Roy James. Still, James found ways to make a comfortable childhood for himself. He was a talented silversmith, to the point that the trinkets and jewelry he crafted were sold in some of London's key department stores. Small and lithe, he was also a strong athlete when it came to water skiing and playing soccer, or football. But in the late 1950s, James found his calling.
I bet he was a good gymnast. I bet he could tumble.
Probably. Tumble.
Small in stature. That dude is doing some power tumbling.
Oh yeah. I remember my friend Christopher, his younger brother Cooper, took up gymnastics when he was probably like 12 or 13.
Yeah.
I remember I hadn't seen Cooper for like a few months. Mm-hmm. Go over to their house and like he'd been doing the rings and stuff like that. And he's just yoked.
Yeah.
You know, it's like seeing your friend's younger brother go from like a scrawny kid to it just be weird. Jacked was so strange.
And that's when you started
just being attracted to him. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was so bizarre. Yeah.
I mean, our CEO, years ago, Matt Levin, during the pandemic, got rings for his garage.
Oh, yeah.
And he is a, you know, nerdy guy.
Yeah.
I hope he doesn't take offense to that. He's very smart.
His channel is all about comic books and stuff. I don't think you'd take offense to that.
Yeah. Never could you see one muscle in his body.
Okay. Well,
and then he comes back from the pandemic and he had been doing rings the whole time.
Yeah.
And he yoked. Is like that type of body where it looks like, Klaus Nomi, you know? God, that's a weird reference.
Yeah, who's Klaus Nomi?
Google Klaus Nomi, he had this like avant-garde tux that has like triangles.
Okay.
And like his traps, like
nobody's gonna get that reference.
I know, but he had so that's all to say that he had this like Johnny triangle Bravo. Body. Johnny Bravo body.
Yeah.
Where he just had this like crazy upper body. I don't know. Rings are the way to go, though.
Rings are the way to go. Anyway, so.
And none of, there's nowhere in this does a character actually do gymnastics.
No, that was all a tangent.
In order to keep
just all because Nolan can't stop thinking about that little boy's body.
That's right. Cooper. All right. In order, I hope he's doing well. In order to help
think about him all the time.
In order to help his family make a living, James had gotten addicted to the adrenaline that accompanied committing crime. His small stature and nimble build meant he could scale walls and climb into the open windows of unsuspecting wealthy people, snatching their valuables and then melting down any jewelry with his silversmithing skills. There was a danger to theft, a thrill, and the only sport that really matched that heart-thumping feeling was karting. During World War II, U.S. Army servicemen stationed in England passed the time zipping around airbases in their little go-karts, enthralling local kids in the process who had never seen these little racing machines. When the war ended, karting had become a critical part of the post-war sporting landscape, and Roy James was one of the many kids who had fallen in love with it.
I didn't realize that karting went back that far. I mean, it makes sense. They had small engines.
That's crazy, huh?
Yeah.
This is one of the few times it's almost backwards with racing coming. It's usually all this stuff came from Europe, and then we tried to adapt it and make it popular, and it didn't work. This is the opposite.
Wow. Yeah. I never realized that. James was a near-natural talent, and by 1962, he was one of Britain's representatives in the European Karting Championships, which meant that he was traveling the continent. In the finals, he won four of the five karting meetings in France and decided that he had a bright future in it. The next rungs on the racing ladder were Formula Junior and Formula Libra, and after watching New Zealander Denny Hulme race to victory in a Brabham, Roy James determined that that was exactly the kind of race car he would need to be successful.
Do you think his name was actually Denny, or do you think that because he had a New Zealand accent, people just...
You think it was Danny?
Yeah.
But people,
Denny.
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 It is.
Breit.
Dennis Clive.
Come on, Breit.
Hulme. Hulme.
Oh, Denny. Denny from Dennis.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't you say there was like a disproportionate amount of dentists named Dennis?
I did say that, but it's up for
It's up for debate.
It's up for debate. It depends on whose data you're looking at. Unfortunately, since that episode, I looked into it again. So there's a strong possibility that there is a statistically significant number of dentists named Dennis. That there could be some form of
just being
causation.
Called Dennis your whole life subconsciously makes you want to become a dentist because that's what people call you.
Power of suggestion.
So, affording a brand new Brabham just like Holmes was no easy task. But by this point, James was 28 years old and had already amassed a lengthy criminal rap sheet thanks to his thievery.
So he's getting caught.
He's getting caught.
He's not just, this isn't just we found out later that he breaks into places and melts down. So
not quite a cat burglar.
This guy's a scumbag. He'd been arrested and served time in prison for stealing and melting down jewelry. But no amount of time behind bars could convince him to hang it up.
Have you heard DJ Khaled say jewelry?
No.
He says jewelry.
Jewelry.
And there's a super cut of him saying like, I got so much jewelry.
I have so much jewelry. I got more jewelry. And it's not even about the jewelry.
Nobody could convince James to hang it up, particularly not when the only way he'd ever managed to afford a motorsport career would be through crime. In fact, he had even gotten comfortable enough to steal the Jaguar of F1 driver Mike Hawthorne to use in a robbery.
That's awesome.
Just for a little extra thrill. And James did eventually return the Jaguar.
Mike Hawthorne went to prison for the robbery.
Alongside his partner, Mickey Ball, James would bolster his karting travels with continental thefts, including stealing jewelry from hotels in Monte Carlo. This guy's just going around.
It's a different time. You know.
It wasn't the most wholesome way to make a living, but it was all Roy James knew.
This is when you catch him with the pearls, and he looks at you and goes, it's a living.
And then he like pulls a parachute.
And after enough jobs robbing people, it meant that he was made enough money to afford that Brabham. This guy literally packs like a black and white striped shirt and like an eye mask in his suitcase.
Now I'm indistinguishable. Yeah. stealing is fun though. I used to steal a lot.
Yeah, like what? Jewels?
Hearts.
Well, it's past the statute of limitations, so I'll go through my rap sheet real quick.
Okay.
One of my biggest scores was a whole box of
Toblerone
Marblites from behind Walgreens.
Like before they loaded them in?
And then it was in the newspaper. It was like
that someone that they that you stole.
Cigarettes. Yeah, but small town.
So
it's not that small. It's not, Milwaukee's not that small a town. There's probably more important stuff going on.
Was it in the like a large Milwaukee newspaper?
It was in it was in the Shorewood Times, which is my suburb. Yeah,
community flyer.
Yeah. Then this was probably my first.
Like police searching for? And did you get nervous about it?
No, it was like a little
local jackass steals.
So it was like a big box of.
It was a box. It had. It had. What, 24 cartons of Marb Lights, which I then sold to all my friends at school for like, I think $10 a carton, which was a deal back then.
Wow.
Because they each had 10 packs in them.
Yeah.
But in the newspaper, it said, so when I found it, it was just next to the dumpster and the loading dock was closed. So they had just forgotten it.
Yeah.
But in the newspaper, it said that a case of cigarettes was stolen from the back of Walgreens, which is like, you forgot it.
Yeah.
I'm sure they reported it to report it so that the guy who forgot it didn't get in trouble.
Yeah, that's probably, I never thought of that. But my first big score, I think I was probably 11, and a card shop had opened pretty close to my school, and they also sold like video games. And so he had a console set up in the back. Like looking back, he was probably 25.
Okay.
And he was very nerdy, but very competitive. So you could like challenge him and be like, I bet I can beat you in Smash Bros. Mm-hmm. And he would load up the N64 and be like, tough shit, dude. Let me beat you. But he was very easy to play into his ego.
His hubris.
And so we were like, okay, here's the plan. Two of us challenge him to Smash Bros. And Joe, who has the biggest cargo pants at the time, go behind the counter.
JNCOs.
Take the jewel cases with the holographic Charizards and whatever comes with that. So that's exactly what happened. And I think I took two jewel cases, put them in my cargo pants, and got out of there. But,
and then what'd you do with them?
They just sat in a binder. They're still in my parents' basement, probably.
Really?
Yeah. I should check. It might be first edition. Man, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely and one holographic Charizard. Yeah. And then probably
that's tainted. You can't unload those.
The serial numbers are toast.
Yeah, they're in the system. They've been reported.
Yeah.
I don't know. What you could do, Joe, sell those carts and use the proceeds to either
go karting.
No, I'll probably. So what
you could give the money back.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make a promise to everyone listening right now that I'm going to sell the holographic Charizard and go on Share the Meal app and buy some meals for kids in Sudan.
That's a good idea.
Promise you that.
That's good. Okay. That's good. In 1963, James really found his stride, winning 12 races in Formula Junior and Formula Libre. Brabham's early skepticism proved to be unfounded to the point that the outfit was talking about adding Roy James to its works team. Oil companies like Esso and Shell were also interested, and it was beginning to look like a future in Grand Prix racing could actually be attainable. That was, at least, until James met the Southwest Gang.
Coming up on the next time on episode 301, we're going to be talking about all the Southwest Gang.
We'll be right back after these messages.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Now back to the show.
Roy James's skill behind the wheel wasn't just being noted by racing enthusiasts. He'd also made it onto the radar of his fellow London criminals, and his work with a specific group named the Southwest Gang was particularly lucrative. In November of 1962, James was one of the getaway drivers during the gang's audacious robbery at London Heathrow Airport.
That's crazy. That's a movie, man.
That's insane.
That's a show. Yeah. It was a show called The Gold, featuring River from Slow Horses. Have you seen Slow Horses?
Yeah. I haven't seen The Gold.
The Gold is good.
Let's keep it.
No. We get to have fun and let this breathe today, baby.
They're saving the steaks at lunch, Nolan, so don't rush us. They'll still be there.
There's no way they're going to save that steak.
I know.
So James's fellow gang members ambush an armored car carrying the payroll for BOAC Airlines. James and his friend Mickey Ball stole some Jaguar Mark IIs to use. Ball drove off with the money while his job was to block traffic or impede the police.
Whoa.
Both getaway drivers were arrested.
I love that these are Guy Ritchie movie names.
I know. Roy Ball.
Mickey Ball.
Hey, Mickey, when are the sausages done?
Mickey Ball.
And go round, round, rerun.
That's like a British Scooby-Doo. Yeah.
So both drivers were arrested, but because no one could pick Roy James out of an identity lineup, he got off scot-free, pumping his heist earnings right back into his racing career. How does that work if you get arrested doing the crime, but nobody can like pick you out?
Yeah, that happens a lot.
Why can't the police pick you out? Being like, oh yeah, that's the guy I arrested.
Because maybe he looks super generic.
So that just means they couldn't. They're like, we arrested these guys. We found these guys in these cars. We arrested them. Are any of these guys the guys that robbed the place? And they're like, I don't know.
So maybe he wasn't arrested on the spot, but later they picked him up in the Jaguar.
That would make sense.
Yeah. And they need like indisputable proof.
Yeah. James also spent plenty of money on his beloved stolen Jaguar, taking time and care to outfit it to better serve as a getaway car. He'd opted for the less powerful 3.4 liter model that made 210 horsepower because he felt it had superior balance. And he'd further refine the machine with better brakes, lowered suspension, and an upgraded cylinder head. He'd also managed to finagle with the electronics so that, with the push of a button, he could turn on his brake lights and throw any pursuers for a loop.
That's cool.
What is he braking? What is he getting away from me if he's braking?
That's some f***ing Mr. Magoo shit.
That is. That level of dedication and craft didn't go unnoticed. He's like the transporter. You know, there's like the scene where Statham's like selecting the right coilover for the car before the job.
You said two people.
Yeah.
I'm not leaving till this.
And then they shoot him in the head.
Right? That movie is so good, dude.
It is really good.
It's so good. So anyway, that level of dedication and craft didn't go unnoticed. And by 1963, Southwest gang leader Bruce Reynolds had firmly adopted James as part of the crew. Reynolds, too, was a regular spectator at racing events. And it's likely that he and James kicked off a strong bond in local paddocks, two men just appreciating each other's skill.
I like your skill.
Thanks to his small size and athleticism, James earned the nickname The Weasel.
And well, hey, man. The Weasel.
Probably sharp. God, he would be the worst part of the crew.
Gracious, yeah.
Dude, it's like, dude, shut up.
Paulie, I'm going to shoot you.
Paulie,
shut your mouth. I'm going to shoot you. Well, like
I'm closing my eyes and it's like I'm there in that Jaguar, you know. It's great. After the BOAC airport heist, Bruce Reynolds was ready for the next job, and he had an idea that was so audacious that his fellow criminals couldn't help but sign on. He was going to rob a Royal Mail train, and he wanted Roy James to help him do it. At the time, the Royal Mail train would run overnight from Glasgow to London, carrying used and therefore largely untraceable £1 and £5 notes that were being taken out of circulation. If someone was able to steal those bills, they'd be able to spend them without any worry of the cops tracking them down based on a serial number. After hearing the idea, Roy James was hooked. If they pulled this off, he'd be able to bring home millions of pounds. British sterling. Even though he'd have to split the cash with the 15-man gang, he'd have enough to finally buy his way into Formula One.
90 million divided by 15. This is like the same thing is oceans.
Yeah.
Like when Frank Ocean put together the crew to get into the Bellagio.
That was Billy Ocean.
Camping Queen. I love that song.
As you'd imagine, James was once again drafted to serve as a getaway driver, which meant that he was likely involved in the planning of the heist, but was probably not responsible for many of the details in the planning. An unknown Royal Mail security officer had leaked details of the train's timing, path, and contents to two Southwest gang members, who then brought the idea to leader Reynolds and another man named Charlie Wilson. Reynolds realized pretty quickly that he'd mastered plenty of criminal activity, but had no idea how exactly to stop and rob a train. So he reached out to another London gang called the South Coast Raiders.
This is a Guy Ritchie movie.
Yeah.
The Raiders had successfully robbed trains in the past and even had someone in their ranks who knew how to rig the trackside signals that would force the train to stop.
But they needed a caravan from the gypsies first.
You like trains?
What are you saying? Chains?
There are a lot of romantic notions about the heist being planned in an old 18th century pub, but it's probably more likely that the work was done at a rundown property named Leather Slade Farm. Reynolds had bought the farm as a hub for the train heist. It would offer enough privacy that they could plan and amass supplies without being seen.
Privacy.
Privacy. And he'd also reckoned it'd make a good hideout after the fact, since he assumed the cops would assume that they'd fled the country.
Yeah, and sheep don't talk.
That's the title
sheep
of the movie.
Sheep don't talk. Sheep don't talk. It's not clear how long the preparations took or how much money was spent, but the crew slowly amassed an Army surplus Austin Lodestar truck, two Land Rovers, and a horse box for the transport of the banknotes. Both Land Rovers were painted the same shade of green and fitted with the same license plate, while other members of the Southwest gang were instructed to amass 2 weeks of supplies for their post-heist hideout on the farm.
That truck thing is like straight out of the Italian Job. Yeah. They had like identical, right? Remember that?
I think so. Roy James mapped out a few different escape routes to allow the gang to disperse down a few different roads after the heist was completed. Then practiced running those routes to make sure he knew he could handle them. 3 days after racing his Brabham at Aintree on Thursday, August 8th, Roy James and his crew struck.
All right, let's pause here.
Okay.
Think about when you come back from a track day and you're just driving your car and it feels like super easy mode and you're just like driving really fast, you know? Mm-hmm. Imagine getting out of like a formula car and getting into a Land Rover and you're just being like, I'm going to smoke everyone who tries to catch me.
This is also one of those, I know it's a lot of money, but you guys are putting in so much work. I mean, imagine what you could do if you had a job, you know?
Like, well, that's that Key and Peele. So
yes.
Where it's like, I got this heist. Mm-hmm. All we got to do is like,
and then they pay us every week.
Yeah. Man, that's just a normal job.
So, the robbers tampered with a signal light at a train crossing between Leighton Buzzard and Cheddington. One of the two train crew members was surprised by the stoppage and climbed out of the cab to place a phone call to find out what was happening, only to discover that the lines had been cut courtesy of one Roy James. All the while, gang members flooded into the cabin, overpowering the one-man crew and beating the other into semi-consciousness. The whole scheme was quite elaborate.
Bad dudes.
Yeah. It required some crew members to unhitch 10 train carriages, then drive the front two carriages, the main cab plus the carriage with all the money, a half a mile down the tracks to stop at the Bridego Railway Bridge. But here came the first problem. The crew had recruited an experienced train driver, only to discover that this recruit had no idea how to drive this specific train.
Yeah. This is out of a movie too, right? Where it's like, oh,
I've never driven a C3.
Yeah.
A Corvette.
I don't know. I figured
all
there's
the,
a train.
All the controls are opposite.
So they had to force the original driver, the one that they'd beaten into a daze, to finish the trek down the tracks. At the train.
Jeez.
At the train bridge, the gang members bashed their way into the money cabin, stuffed that cash into sacks, and tossed them down onto the waiting getaway cars. Within 30 minutes, they'd amassed £2.6 million, When converted to U.S. dollars and adjusted for inflation, that's around $65 million wow. today. But here came the second problem. As the gang departed, one of the gang members told the train conductors not to call the police or even move for 30 minutes. When they told that fact to the cops assumed that this meant the robbers were hiding out somewhere within a 30-minute drive, meaning they could kick off their search immediately and keep it narrow. In the morning, as word spread of this audacious heist, so too did word that police were offering a 10,000 pound reward for any information pertaining to the crime. As it turned out, someone did have information, a neighbor near Leather Slade Farm. Once vacant, the area had suddenly become a hub of activity over the past few days, and the neighbor believed it could have something to do with that train heist. Meanwhile, the robbers thought they'd gotten off scot-free, at least for a few hours. They settled into their hideaway and turned on the radio, only to discover that the police were already scanning the area. They quickly engaged in a getaway scheme, painting the Lodestar truck and spilling that paint on their shoes in the process, forgetting some of their mailbags, and critically, failing to clean up any of their fingerprints.
This is like the part of the movie where they get pulled over by the bobbies, and they're like, step out of the vehicle, and they have paint on their shoes. And so he's like thinking quick, he like takes his shoes off because like a ticket for driving without any shoes would be better than getting caught.
When the cops raided the place 5 days after the heist, they found enough evidence to identify the robbers and send them to prison for years. Because remember, all these guys
are just getting busted
all the time. Yep. On August 10th, James used his personal Jaguar to ferry cash between the farmhouse and a garage in the east end of London. However, he was convinced he and the rest of the crew had gotten away with their heist. And on August 18th, 1963, he won a Formula Junior race at Cadwell Park.
So nothing's, this is the interim.
Yeah.
The cops have all the evidence they need. They're building the case. Nobody knows about it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. James also entered a race the following weekend at Goodwood, where he'd be able to measure his talent against some of the greatest drivers of the era in the annual Tourist Trophy. Before he could arrive, a detective sergeant, Jack Slipper, had managed to identify James by discovering his fingerprints on a few different items at the farmhouse, on a page from a magazine, and on a first aid kit, and on a Pyrex dish he'd used to feed the farm cat.
So he was, this is the detective going like, oh, he microwaved something in the Pyrex and then cut his finger and used the first aid kit while also flipping through a magazine.
If it's a crime to use a Pyrex to feed a cat, then I'm guilty.
Lock me up for life.
Lock me up for life. But as of this day right now, you got nothing but the fact that I love animals. And I'll tell you what, I love reading magazines. Better luck next time.
Detective Jack Slipper loudly made his presence known, and James learned he was being pursued well before race day.
Which is funny because that's the opposite of what slippers do.
That's true. That's true.
Giving him plenty of time to escape.
If you're going to try to catch somebody,
just be quiet.
Just sneak up on him.
Yeah.
Hey!
Yeah.
I'm here to arrest you, James Roy. 100 yards away! I'm here to arrest you!
All right, man, I drive a race car. See you later.
A week later, an edition of Motoring News magazine included the quip, quote, a notable non-starter was Roy James, who did not appear on Saturday. Scotland Yard, it seems, wished to interview him, and James was not to be found. And James was determined to keep it that way. So here we go. We got a racing driver on the lam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The cops are closing in. He loves cats.
Yeah.
He loves racing.
He loves magazines.
He loves magazines. I mean, aside from the robbery, he and I have a lot of shared interests.
Yeah. So the police set up a race with a prize too big that they knew he'd show up.
It's
a fat kitty cat.
The race, the grand prize is a smelter.
We'll be right back after these messages.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying.
If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Now back to the show.
After fleeing from Goodwood, Roy James packed up a few of his belongings and found a room to hide out somewhere in Ryder's Terrace. For weeks, he was virtually undetectable, until someone informed police that she thought she'd seen one of the train robbers entering a nearby apartment. Because I'm sure at this point, like in newspapers and maybe on TV, like they have these guys' mugshots all over everywhere. The place.
His mugshot is like just the top of his head because he's so short.
Early on the morning of December 10th, over 4 months after the heist had taken place, police burst through the door of the apartment James was staying in.
Yeah, that's how you do it. You surprise him.
Yeah.
I've been saying the whole time.
But James wasn't going down and out without a fight. Clad in only his underwear, he snatched a suitcase filled with 12,000 pounds and jumped out the window, making a desperate attempt to outrun the police by leaping from one rooftop to the next.
Oh, that's fun. In his underwear with a briefcase? Yeah,
that's so sick. His briefs and his brief.
Oh, nice. This will be a briefcase is what the detective is saying.
Unfortunately, James didn't quite make it. James was arrested in someone's backyard, and he was taken to a holding cell awaiting a trial scheduled to begin on January 20th, 1964. 51 days later, James's sentence was handed down. 25 years in prison for conspiracy to rob and 30 years for armed robbery, though he'd be allowed to serve both sentences at the same time.
We call that concurrently.
Yes. But the judge said it was necessary.
I watched Law and Order.
But it was a huge sentence, but the judge said it was necessary because, quote, to deal with this case leniently would be a positively evil thing.
I think it was maybe too much time.
The reason they did it, though, is he's like, we can't have another train robbery.
This
like
was this. A precedent.
Yeah, that's set
if
up.
If I don't punish these guys.
Like the woman who got fined $200,000 for downloading Britney Spears in 2006.
Right.
Gotta set the precedent. Yeah.
Now no one listens to Britney Spears. That's the lesson they were trying to teach her.
Roy James was cuffed and taken to a London prison called Wormwood Scrubs.
Oh, that's such a good, that's a Guy Ritchie.
Great names.
Yeah.
Great name.
Where he was immediately placed in solitary confinement for the first 8 months of his stay.
You sending me this shoe?
Some of James's fellow robbers had already been sentenced, and two of them had already tried to escape. Knowing how quick James was to take to the rooftops, they'd assumed he'd be a flight risk right out of the gate. When he was sentenced, Roy James was 29 years old, the youngest of the train robbers. His 30-year sentence meant he'd be 59 when he was freed from prison, too old to pick up his racing career. Still, he needed a way to pass the time while in confinement. He'd flip through the specialist racing publications that the prison allowed him to read.
I told you I love me magazines.
Watching from afar as Formula One evolved from the cigar-tube-shaped chassis he'd known to the sleek, winged wedges designed to make the most of a growing interest in aerodynamics. It's also likely that he sent letters to plenty of folks in the racing world because he'd received plenty of visitors, many of whom advocated for an early release on his behalf. Among some of the more notable friends were Val Peary, who was Stirling Moss's longtime secretary, and a saloon car racer named David Brody. When Roy James was released from prison in 1975, he'd been let out after serving just 12 years of his 30-year sentence. I think that's pretty fair.
Yeah, 12 years. Yeah.
He was determined to get back behind the wheel. James went straight from the track to try his hand at testing a Formula Ford, and he was ultimately given a formal Formula Atlantic test by David Mills, who would go on to manage the career of racer Derek Bell. Quote, I was asked to help him by all sorts of people in the business, Mills told Motorsport magazine. I think the racing fraternity felt that it had been a terribly long sentence. 30 years. That's life. He was a nice enough chap, outgoing, many people liked him, and felt he had served more than enough time.
He liked cats.
I had a Lola, which Ted Wentz had been driving in Atlantic and then F2, and at the end of the season, we put the Ford BDA Atlantic engine back in it for James to test, and I issued a press release saying, quote, Roy James returns to racing. But according to Mills, the test wasn't exactly promising. Even though Roy James had stayed in good shape in prison, he'd lost his instincts. After dipping a wheel off into the grass during his Silverstone Formula Atlantic test, James careened right into the crash barriers and he broke his leg. As Mills recalled, quote, I think motor racing was his lifeline. He just kept it in his sights that one day he'd come out and be a racing driver again. He was so keen. I can't describe how excited he was to drive a racing car around the circuit again. And he was getting down to some good times when he went off. That was the end of his dream. Such a shame.
It's just a leg, though.
It's just a leg.
You can press the gas.
It's not like he had his foot in his lap.
Yeah.
James even got a little interview in Autosport where he said, quote, my times were coming down nicely, and I've had to have a decent position on the grid. After 12 years, it felt good, and I was elated. I can't wait to have a go again. Time is not on my side. I can't afford to miss a day. But James couldn't afford a lot of things, including racing. He'd squirreled away some of the heist funds before he was sent to jail, but the folks in charge of managing that money for him had spent it. Clocking in at 40 years old and with a broken leg from the Formula Atlantic crash, sponsors kept their distance from Roy James. Despite continually claiming that he had a clear path to Formula One ahead of him, the best he could manage was a little help from John Webb, the managing director of Motor Circuit Developments. Webb was able to organize a brief schedule of races for James at the circuits he owned, thinking he'd be able to reap the rewards of the publicity bonanza. Webb offered James a Royale RP21 to race in a few Formula Ford 1600 events.
It's going to be a publicity bonanza, trust me.
In his first race at Mallory Park on August 1st, 1976, the very same day that Formula One legend Niki Lauda was involved in his near-fatal crash at the Nürburgring, James spun at the S's and knocked every wheel off his car.
Wow.
Later, he frustrated a young Nigel Mansell by wiping out the future world champion. Then, in November, he took pole position and was fighting for the lead of the race when he rode up the back tire of the race leader and launched into a series of cartwheels. Somehow, he walked away with nothing more than a few bruises. And that was the last time James drove an open-wheeled race car.
Yeah, I think I would probably retire after doing cartwheels in my car.
When it finally became clear that his racing career wasn't going to get off the ground in any traditionally meaningful way, thanks to spending his best racing years behind bars, Roy James decided it was time to take some of the other tools of his trade and turn them into a career. James had a knack for silversmithing after a childhood of growing up stealing, then melting jewelry. He had plenty of time to refine his craft while in prison. In fact, he was even able to turn his skills to good use on commission from Bernie Ecclestone.
Oh.
Roy James designed and manufactured the trophy that would go on to be handed to the best annual Formula One race promoter during the season, a season-ending FIA award ceremony, which was first awarded in 1975 and last awarded in 2019. So, what? If you were the best race promoter, you got a trophy.
Yeah, made out of pure silver?
The trophy consists of a race car on a pedestal surrounded by a big octagon, all of it made from metal. I'm not sure which kind of metal. Over the next four decades, the folks who put on the best F1 event of the season got to take home a display piece crafted by one of the great train robbers, and many of them probably had no idea that this was the case.
So, safe to say that no one from Monaco has gotten this. Right?
It's hard to pass there.
Quote,
I heard that laugh before.
I know. I liked it. Don't.
Yeah.
Quote, I gave him a trophy to make, Ecclestone said. As reported by Autosport, he'd been a silversmith and a goldsmith. That's still the trophy we give to the promoters every year. He made it. The recipients don't realize it.
Okay.
Cool quote.
Cool, man. He was like late for a meeting.
Yeah.
So just gonna, who do you want to know about? Oh, yeah. He gave us a trophy to make, and people don't know he did it. All right. I'll see you guys later.
It's something. Run it.
Yeah.
And the man who told Ecclestone to hire James? None other than Graham Hill, the two-time Formula One world champion and the only driver to achieve the coveted Triple Crown with wins at Indy 500, 24 Hours of Le Mans, and Grand Prix at Monaco.
Great mustache, too.
That's the thing about Roy James. He had friends just about everywhere. In 1982, Roy James got married to a woman named Anthea Wadlow, who was 30 years his junior. The following year, he and fellow great train robber Charlie Wilson were investigated for importing gold without paying duties, but James was ultimately acquitted. Then in 1993, after he and his wife had broken up, and after he came to collect their children for visitation, an argument erupted between James and his former father-in-law, David Wadlow, that ended in James shooting Wadlow three times, then pistol whipping and strangling his ex-wife.
Jesus.
Both Wadlows survived, miraculously.
Whoa.
And Roy James was ultimately sentenced to 6 years in jail for the crime.
Six years? 30 for the train.
I know. What? Only six for shooting a guy three times.
What the hell?
Crazy.
Send him back. Yeah. I don't like this guy anymore.
In 1996, he underwent a triple bypass heart surgery, then was released from prison the following year. Not long after, on August 21st, 1997, Roy James died of a heart attack, and just like that, the youngest member of the Southwest Gang was gone. The Great Train Robbery is one of the most memorable and mythologized heists in history, spawning countless films, TV shows, books, even board games and video games, and a theater performance, as well as tons of deeply accurate recountings and retellings. Naturally, the whole event became firmly embedded in the British national consciousness. But honestly, it shouldn't come as much of a surprise that the worlds of crime and motorsport intersected in one of the wildest heists in history. Motorsport has encouraged people to kill, steal, smuggle drugs, and concoct elaborate schemes just to scrounge enough money to buy a car and hit the track. And so many of those crimes involved in the same adrenaline-fueled and testosterone-soaked behavior we associate so closely with racing. Things may not have worked out particularly well for old Roy James's racing career, but he certainly did go down in history, maybe just not the way that he would have liked. And that is the story.
Heavy ending.
Yeah. I was kind of like, kind of fun for most of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then he did
Everybody was rooting for this guy, too. Yeah.
The whole domestic abuse thing happened.
Not good.
Jeez.
Yeah.
It is true that
motorsport and crime intersect.
Yeah.
Quite often. Yeah.
I didn't think about it that much, but there is the like brothers who raced in NASCAR that smuggled drugs. Mm-hmm.
There was a guy who did IndyCar who smuggled drugs.
Yeah, he was also in like IMSA. He had like some lobster company like sponsored his car, but he smuggled like weed.
Pablo Escobar raced himself.
Yeah.
Down in Colombia.
Anyway, wow, what a crazy story, man.
Yeah.
Really wild. So thank you guys so much for listening. We got more episodes on the way for you. Follow Bart at BidsBardo. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Big thank you to our writer this week, the great Elizabeth Blackstock. Go check out Deadly Passions, Terrible Joys, her podcast. And big thank you to our crew as well, Audrey and Edgar behind the camera there and behind the mixing board. And our editor, Mark Schroeder, for putting the show together. Thank you guys again for listening. We will see you next week. All right. Bye.
Bye.